Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Kaelin Davenport, lecturer in Roman history at Macquarie University. This is episode LXXXIV, The African Emperor. The Roman Empire shatters in the wake of Commodus's death, which, if you recall, was a matter of months but a whole two emperors ago. Striding into Rome at the head of an army is Septimius Severus, ready to set the right path and form a powerful new dynasty. Here's Kaelin Davenport.
Septimius Severus is another senatorial general, but he's of a different breed to Pertinax. He is almost like a workhorse. He's a man whose career has been going along. He rises up through the ranks, but he doesn't seem particularly distinguished. Indeed, if you asked out of all the governors of important provinces under the reign of Commodus who was going to be emperor, he probably wouldn't have said Septimius Severus.
I've been reading a lot of Dio and the Augustan histories at this point. His name hasn't come up at all. You know, we've heard about Pertinax, we've heard about Claudius Pompeianus all the way through these previous emperors, and there's been no mention of Septimius Severus. So he seems to be somebody who's very much gone under the radar, hasn't distinguished himself hugely, hasn't been involved in the imperial circle at all.
No, I mean, his career has suffered a few setbacks as well. So, you know, the fact that he becomes emperor in 193 is really quite extraordinary. I mean, even his rivals, Clodius Albinus and Pescennius Niger, you know, distinguished themselves in warfare under Commodus. So it's an interesting twist of fate that we end up talking about Septimius Severus founding the Severan dynasty, which would continue the legacy of the Antonines.
So can we talk about his early life? What do we know about his origins, where he was born?
Yeah, so Severus is from Leptis Magna, which is in modern-day Libya. It's a fantastic Roman site. Hopefully one day I would like to go and visit it. So he is an African emperor. He comes from the municipal aristocracy of Leptis Magna. And what we mean by that, the wealthy people who are town councillors, who sponsor games, they're local notables.
And during that time, is it a big settlement? What sort of scale are we talking about? Is it backwaters?
It's a large settlement. I mean, it's one of the three major cities in the region. It was made a Roman colony from the time of Trajan onwards, which is a great distinction.
Right.
It's really a major city of North Africa, and people from Leptis Magna had entered the equestrian and the senatorial orders, including members of Septimius Severus's own family.
Okay, and what year was he born in?
So he was born in 145 AD in the reign of Antoninus Pius. His father, Publius Septimius Geta, doesn't seem to have held any major office, but they were wealthy. The family was of equestrian status, which means they had a fortune of at least 400,000 sesterces. So they're part of the wealthy local elites in the Roman world.
And what about as far as Septimius Severus's ancestry? What's his background there?
Descendant of Italian colonists, so people that have moved from Italy to settle Leptis Magna, as well as he has descendants from the local Libyan side as well there.
I've seen a lot of talk online about him being held up as a black emperor. I don't know whether this just refers to him being from Africa, from that region, or if it actually being an accurate assessment of his heritage. Where do you weigh in on that kind of thing?
Well, we definitely know he has, you know, both Italian and local ancestry. We do actually have one colour portrait of Septimius Severus, and this is the infamous Berlin Tondo, which you can see now in Museum in Berlin, which shows Septimius Severus. And he does have dark brown skin, not a black African, but he does definitely have that skin tone of people that you might see from modern day Libya today as well. He was highly educated in Latin and Greek, but he also had a provincial accent, as lots of people who came from Africa and then made their names in Italy did. They slurred their S's. Burley says he probably would have pronounced his own name Septimius Severus. It sounds a bit like Sean Connery trying
to say that. It's almost a bit for Sean Connery.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, he would definitely stand out, you know, when he goes to Rome to make his fame and fortune. You know, he sets out for Rome in 162 and enters the Senate with support of one of his senatorial relatives. He would stand out as someone who spoke with a provincial accent.
Yeah.
Much the same way as, you know, when I went to England, you know, I sound Australian. They're not Australians, where I sound English. He has this ancestry, he has senatorial members in his family, but he's still definitely a provincial who goes to Rome to make it big.
Mm.
And he's spotted by Marcus Aurelius, and Marcus Aurelius makes him a member of the Senate.
So is this the career path that he was aiming for at this point, that he would become a member of the Senate and work his way through those kind of roles in Rome?
Yeah, that does seem to be what he was aiming for. His senatorial career is not as rapid or distinguished as many other of his peers. However, later on, we have all these omens which start to circulate about how when he went to Rome, there were all these signs and portents about how he would become emperor. So the historian Augusta says, on his arrival at Rome, he chanced upon an innkeeper who was reading the life of the Emperor Hadrian at that very time. This he seized upon as an omen of future good fortune.
So that would have been a public reading kind of thing that would have been done at the time. And the autobiography of Hadrian, which is a text that I wish we still had.
Oh, so do I.
is maybe not necessarily assigned to the one person, because a lot of people would have heard about that or interpreted it. So it sounds like a bit of a retconned sign.
Oh, there's lots of retcons going on. Once Septimius Severus succeeds in becoming emperor, all the stories of omens and portents start to come. And we know that Cassius Dio, great guide for so much of this period, his first work was about the omens and portents which led Septimius Severus to hope for imperial power.
Mm. So what other signs were of note here?
Oh, there's some wonderful ones, you know, that he went to an imperial banquet wearing the wrong clothing and was given the emperor's own toga to put on. There's another story about how he accidentally sat in the imperial throne. I mean, all these are signs that one day you'd become emperor, as if anyone would accidentally sit in the emperor's throne. It's hardly believable. Also, he dreamed that he was sucking the teats of a she-wolf, like Romulus and Remus, of course,
yeah.
The founders of Rome. There's also some good ones later on when he was governor of Gallia Lugdunensis, when he dreamed the entire Roman people came up and saluted him. In another dream later on, a horse was riding through the Roman Forum with Pertinax on its back, and it threw Pertinax off, and then Septimius Severus got on the horse, and it was fine, and so Septimius Severus rode on. The idea that, you know, when Pertinax is killed, Septimius Severus would continue, there'd be no problem. One of my favourite ones is actually about his marriage to Julia Domna, who's his second wife. And Cassius Dio says, when he was about to marry Julia, Faustina, the wife of Marcus, prepared their nuptial chamber in the Temple of Venus near the palace. And this would be very important because Septimius Severus later on casts himself as the son of Marcus Aurelius. So it's this divine blessing from Marcus Aurelius' wife that his dynasty is going to continue. So I'm sure there are many more that filled Cassius Dio's book on the dreams and portents, and I'm sure it became a bestseller.
under the rule of Septimius Severus,
oh, sure. Of course, yes, yeah.
So what do we need to know then about his career prior to 193 when he became emperor?
Yeah, so he had a bit of a slow start. You know, he enters the Senate, then he goes to Sardinia as quaestor, and then becomes legate to the proconsul of Africa. That's like the assistant to the proconsul of Africa, who happens to be one of his own relatives in the 170s. I suppose a key moment is in the early 180s when he is commander of a legion in Syria, when Pertinax is governor.
Mm.
So the two men had actually met and knew each other well before Septimius Severus succeeded him as emperor. But the thing about Septimius Severus is that his career is very slow. One might have expected, if you were a favoured senator, an up-and-comer, that after being a legionary legate, you would then go on to hold the consulship and then be promoted to consular governorships, where you'd command many legions. But Septimius Severus wasn't advanced immediately to the consulship. He had to go and be a governor of a small Praetorian province, Gallia Lugdunensis, in the late 180s. So this is about 20 years after he'd been advanced into the Senate. Gaul, it's a nice province, you know, southern France, it's lovely, but it's not a place that's going to win you lots of glory. And when he did become consul, it was in 190. He was aged 44. So above the minimum age. And this was the infamous year of the 25 consuls.
Right. So being consul in this year wasn't necessarily anything noteworthy with that many people getting it.
Not at all, because basically Cleander, Commodus's henchman, was selling off the consulship. You know, he was infamous for selling off, you know, governorships and other honours. So Commodus was consul at the beginning of the year, resigned after a few days, and then basically Cleander was selling off as many consulships as he could. So for Septimius Severus to get the consulship in that year is not a good sign that he'd been marked out for future glory. He basically gets it because he pays for it.
What do we know about his family life during this time?
Yes, so he's married twice. His first wife, Paccia Marciana, is also from Leptis Magna, and she accompanies him on his governorships, but she dies when Septimius Severus is governor of Gallia Lugdunensis in 186. So then he starts to look around for a second wife. According to Historia Augusta, he had two daughters from his first wife, but we don't know whether that's accurate, and he certainly had no sons. Mm. Allegedly, he starts to consult horoscopes for who should be his best match, and comes across a woman in Syria who had been foretold that she would marry a king. This may again be later retconning of Septimius Severus's career. And this is Julia Domna, Septimius Severus's second and most famous wife. It's probable that Septimius Severus actually met her when he was in Syria as a legionary legate, because Julia Domna is a Syrian from Emesa, and she is the daughter of the high priest of the local cult of the sun god, Elagabal.
He gets married to her quite quickly after the death of his first wife, doesn't he?
That's right. Paccia Marciana dies in 186, then he goes off and marries Julia Domna. She comes to Gaul to be with him, and they have two sons very quickly. The first, Lucius Septimius Bassianus, is born in 188, and the second, Publius Septimius Geta, is born in 189. Publius Septimius Geta is the name of Septimius Severus's father and his son. Now, Lucius Septimius Bassianus is probably better known to us as the Emperor Caracalla. He goes through various name changes. Caracalla is a nickname, but for those of you who have heard of Caracalla, this is who Lucius Septimius Bassianus is going to grow up to be.
I think it's never a good idea to name yourself after an item of clothing if you're a Roman emperor. It's not a good sign. So at the end of 192, Commodus dies and Pertinax is made the emperor, but is very quickly killed himself. What situation is Septimius Severus in at this time, and what's his first move?
Well, Septimius Severus is governor of Pannonia Superior. This is a province with two legions on the Danubian frontier, so he's in a position of power, and he's been governor of this province since 191. So when Pertinax is emperor, Septimius Severus continues to govern the province, just as been appointed. But when he hears that Pertinax has been murdered, he moves very quickly. So Pertinax is murdered on the 28th of March, and on the 9th of April, Septimius Severus is proclaimed emperor by the legions.
And this is the date that he will count his emperorship from, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. So he ignores Didius Julianus, essentially. Mm. The 9th of April is what we call his dies imperii, his day of becoming emperor, essentially. We know that he had rivals, so he's not the only man who's taken it upon himself to declare himself emperor in response to the death of Pertinax. He has two rivals, Pescinius Niger, who's the governor of Syria, another important military province, and Clodius Albinus, who is governor of Britain.
I find that interesting that you've got Niger and Albinus, black and white.
Yes.
One on each side of him.
That's great. I never thought of that before, but you're completely right.
You never thought of that before.
No, no, it's blindingly obvious now I think of it. But, you know, Roman historians, we just get too tangled up in the minutiae of things.
So how does he treat these two rivals then? What's his plan for his march on Rome?
Yeah, so he leaves Niger B for the moment. So, no, he's in Syria. He's got three legions. And Niger's clearly drawing upon the other governors for support. But Septimius Severus wants to march on Rome to take on Didius Julianus. So for that to happen, most pressing is to get Clodius Albinus on side to make sure that he doesn't also launch an attempt on the throne. So he offers Clodius Albinus the junior rank of Caesar. Now, this is a rank which is usually given to imperial heirs. So either the son by blood of an emperor or an adoptive son. So we saw, for example, how Hadrian's heir, his first heir, was Aulus Caesar. And, for example, Marcus Aurelius was Caesar in the reign of Antoninus Pius. But here we have an emperor sort of entering into a loose power-sharing arrangement by nominating another senator as Caesar. And this is really to make sure that he's not fighting wars on three fronts.
Yeah.
And you know, keeping Britain at bay. Now, Clodius Albinus must have known this would only be temporary. I mean, Septimius Severus had two sons of his own. Yes, they were young. You know, they're only boys at the time. But still, if Septimius Severus is going to be successful, he's going to take Rome. And, you know, he's got two sons. That's actually quite rare to have two sons for a Roman emperor. You know, Clodius Albinus must have known there was going to be some sort of showdown later. But for the moment, he's content to take the title. You know, he mints coins as Caesar. So that's the way that Septimius Severus sort of neutralizes that potential threat.
So essentially, he becomes emperor with no opposition. And that's the benefit of having a mighty army at the doorstep of Rome, I suppose.
Yes, the Senate, you know, quite happily declares Didius Julianus a public enemy and has him executed. I mean, this is because Septimius Severus says that he will pardon the people of Rome and the Senate as long as they kill the murderers of Pertinax.
Mm.
And so Didius Julianus declared a public enemy. There's no opposition in Rome, and Septimius Severus executes the Praetorians who murdered Pertinax. You know, this is part of his mission, to portray himself as the avenger of Pertinax. And then he quite exceptionally discharges the rest of the Praetorian Guard. And I think this is a really key moment in Roman history, because up to this point, the Praetorians were always recruited from Italian soldiers.
Yeah.
You know, it was a great privilege to be a Praetorian. You were better paid and you had shorter service. You only served for 16 years as opposed to 25 if you were legionary. So Septimius Severus discharges the Praetorians and replaces them with troops from his own legions that have marched on Rome with him. So Praetorians who have presided over the acclamation of Pertinax and especially the sale of the empire to Didius Julianus, they're gone. They're replaced with men that Septimius Severus could trust. And this would really change Praetorian recruitment for, well, for the rest of their existence until they're disbanded by Constantine. Italians continue to be recruited in the 3rd century into Praetorian Guard, but in much smaller numbers. They now had to compete with other legionaries from other legions stationed all across the empire who would want to be promoted into the Praetorian Guard.
So now Rome's got their third emperor for the year. So the city must be thinking to itself, well, happy new year again. Happy yes. new year. What sort of start did Septimius Severus make to his reign? What sort of impression is he trying to give the Senate and the people of Rome?
It's a wonderful entrance into the city of Rome. Septimius Severus enters in civilian attire. You don't want to enter as a conquering general with the city of Rome.
Yeah, with a sword, yeah.
Yep, but he still enters with his army. So there's a concession there to senatorial sensibilities there. Cassius Dio, who was there, tells us about the entrance in Book 75, 1.3-5. The spectacle proved the most brilliant of any that I have witnessed. For the whole city had been decked with garlands of flowers and laurel and adorned with richly coloured stuffs, and it was ablaze with torches and burning incense. The citizens, wearing white robes with radiant countenances, uttered many shouts of good omen. The soldiers, too, stood out conspicuous in their armour as they moved about, like participants in the holiday procession. And finally, we senators were walking about in state. The crowd chafed in its eagerness to see him, to hear him say something, as if he had somehow been changed by his good fortune. And some of them held one another aloft, so that from that high position they might catch sight of him. So Septimius Severus is really being greeted as a saviour.
Yeah, very much a enthusiastic welcome from Rome by the sounds of it.
Yes, I mean, this is a chance to put, you know, the past 5 months behind them and move on with stable government. And Septimius Severus starts off well. Cassius Dio says he makes promises to the Senate. You know, he would not put any senator to death. You know, that was always a sign of a good emperor. Of course, later on, as Cassius Dio remarks, rather ironically, he killed the man who framed this decree. He killed the senator, Julius Solon. But that would be several years later. at the same time, not a good look for Septimius Severus. And Dio certainly complains about the fact that all these troops are now suddenly in the city of Rome, and he criticises Septimius Severus's reliance on the army. Now, Dio certainly has an agenda to grind here. In his history, Dio presents himself as the voice of the Senate. And it's very seductive to think that Dio's view is that of all senators. It's probably that of many senators, but it's probably not that of all senators. And Dio's literary career gives us some guide to his evolving assessment of Septimius Severus. So we know originally he wrote a sycophantic account of the dream's importance that brought Septimius Severus to power, which he sent to the emperor, and the emperor wrote back saying how much he loved that, understandably.
Yes.
He also wrote an account of the civil wars, which brought Septimius Severus to power. And these little works were later integrated into his 80-book magnum opus, The Roman History. However, by the time he came to write the Roman history, which was probably after the death of Septimius Severus, his opinion of the emperor had changed in many ways, and particularly his favouritism towards the soldiers. But we shouldn't take this as indicative of the fact that Septimius Severus hated all senators, because he didn't. He relied on many key senatorial generals to support him both in the civil wars and his Parthian wars. So Dio criticises him for not relying on his associates, and Dio, that means people like me in the Senate. But Septimius Severus did have senatorial supporters whom commanded his armies and whom Septimius Severus lavished with property and goods and honours.
That's interesting, that opinion change that he had then. So he's come into Rome as the avenger of Pertinax in one aspect, so a quick move to make would be to deify Pertinax.
Yes, this was a major part of his propaganda campaign when he's in Rome. This is, you know, the emperor who Didius Julianus had left rotting on the floor of the palace. Septimius Severus makes him a god and holds a lavish funeral, you know, the three-tiered funeral pyre involving members of the Senate, the equestrian order, the songs, troops riding around the pyre. It's the full ceremony. Cassius Dio provides great detail about the funeral of Pertinax. He says, "In the Roman Forum, a wooden platform was constructed hard by the marble rostra, upon which was set a shrine without walls, but surrounded by columns, cunningly wrought of both ivory and gold. In it was placed a bier of the same materials, surrounded by heads of both land and sea animals, and adorned with coverlets of purple and gold. Upon this rested an effigy of Pertinax in wax, laid out in triumphal garb, and a comely youth was keeping the flies away with it with peacock feathers, as though it were really a person sleeping."
Wow.
And this is Cassius Dio, 75, chapter 4, sections 1 to 2.
It's a very elaborate kind of send-off, really. It's a religious ceremony as well, isn't it?
Definitely. I mean, yeah. It's not just a funeral, it's a ceremony of consecration. You know, as part of this ceremony, Pertinax becomes a god. And Cassius Dio tells us, you know, there are choruses of boys and men who sing hymns. There are images of all the subject nations who are under Rome's sway, images of distinguished senators, you know, the cavalry and infantry, the emperor, the equestrians, the corporations of the city, and then following them, Dio says, came an altar gilded all over and adorned with the ivory and gems of India. when you think of what's been going on in Rome, the slaughter, you know, the people cry out in the Circus Maximus for Piscinius Niger. Mm. Now, this is a ceremony that's designed to really unite them and bring the period of turbulence to a close. And this is a way of showing the fact that Septimius Severus is not someone who murdered Commodus.
Mm.
He is the avenger of Pertinax. And this will become key later on when he tries to make himself part of the Antonine dynasty. The funeral ceremony essentially acts as an act of catharsis for the people of Rome. It brings to conclusion that dreadful period over the past few months, and now Rome is united in support of Septimius Severus. And he really needed this support before he took on one of his other rivals, Piscinius Niger, in Syria.
That's Dr. Kaelin Davenport, lecturer in Roman history at Macquarie University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow myself and Kaelin on Twitter. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport, and I am at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, Septimius Severus solidifies the sovereign situation. But until then, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.